Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can we come to terms with the legacy of American slavery and the racial and economic injustices that have followed its abolition? Houston Chronicle reporter Chris Tomlinson spent years covering ethnic violence abroad before turning his investigative focus on his own ancestors, some of whom had kept people in slavery, and some of whom had mythologized that reality to convince themselves that no real harm had been done. Tomlinson also learned that the site of what had once been his family's plantation was still home to black families with the Tomlinson surname, descendants of the people his ancestors had kept in bondage. Chris Tomlinson's new book is called Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. He has a signing event this evening at the Barnes & Noble on Northwest Highway in Dallas at 7 o'clock, and we're delighted he could be here. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
Start off by telling us about your reporting career and how that set you up to work on a project like this one.
Well, my first reporting job was in South Africa, working for a Japanese newspaper, actually, covering the end of apartheid. It was 1993, early 1994, and the country was caught in ethnic conflict between the Zulus and the Xhosa, who were fighting for political power as the white government stepped down. From there, I went on to Rwanda, where I covered the end of the genocide and post-genocidal Rwanda. And over the course of 14 years, I kind of became an expert on why people hate each other. I covered 9 wars total, and almost all of them had this element of bigotry, whether it was based on race, ethnicity, religion, or even cousinhood, like in Somalia. You know, they don't divide themselves up by clan, but by sub-clan, basically who your cousin is. And that got me thinking about my own family's history in the United States.
What did you know about that history when you were a kid?
I didn't know much. My grandfather used to say that our family held slaves on a plantation called Tomlinson Hill, and they loved us so much they took Tomlinson as their last name. Of course, this story made my father wince a little bit. I think he understood early on that that wasn't actually the way things happened.
Mm-hmm.
But that was about all that I knew. My father never took me to Tomlinson Hill. It wasn't a part of our life. And so when I set out on this journey, I really wasn't sure what I'd find.
Were you afraid of what you would find?
By the time I got started, I knew that it wasn't going to be pretty.
Mm-hmm.
After 20 years as a foreign correspondent, it was, you know, I'd seen enough. I'd seen lynchings. I'd seen violent bigotry. I'd seen oppression. I knew what was involved in maintaining control over a minority to the degree that whites maintained that control over blacks during slavery and during Jim Crow. I wasn't ready for all of it, though. There were many surprises.
Stories like these are fascinating to consider when they involve family and ancestors that, if you don't remember them, maybe your grandfather remembered his grandfather, that sort of thing. Because, I mean, you can see how they get mythologized. Because if your grandfather loved his grandfather, it would be hard to sort of paint him in the either all evil or all good categories that we seem to be most comfortable with.
Well, I certainly have broken one of the cardinal sins of being a good Southerner, is I'm speaking ill of the dead. It's only natural that we want to honor the people that we loved. And it's also, I think, only natural to want to honor your own life. One of the surprising things I found was the systematic way that Confederate veterans in the 1890s became concerned about their legacy, mm-hmm. and began to rewrite this history and create this mythology. One of my ancestors writes about his concern that in the 1890s, public school children were being taught the wrong things about the Confederacy, and that they needed to be taught it was about states' rights and not slavery, and that the people who defended slavery shouldn't be portrayed in a negative light. So there is that element of we want to honor our ancestors, but there was also a very systematic effort to go to the school boards and say, you know, we want to teach a different version of our history.
You went to school right around here, and I was interested to read about the way that slavery was dealt with in your classes in this really passive way.
Well, I'm a native Dallasite. I was caught up in busing in the desegregation of Dallas schools. So I went to three elementary schools in 3 years, and then to a junior high, Robert T. Hill Junior High, and ultimately Skyline High School.
It took Dallas a much long – you're young, but it took Dallas a very long time to actually desegregate.
We're talking about 1974, 1975, when busing was really beginning to make a real difference in Dallas schools. It was that late, and it was under federal court order that this happened. But yes, we were taught about slavery, but it was a passive voice. You know, slavery was bad, and it was something in the past, and there was no agency as to who was, no discussion of who was really responsible.
Do you think that was because teachers just were uncomfortable with the topic? Would you think they thought maybe kids couldn't handle that and that it would be, you know, brawls on the playground, that sort of thing?
I think it was the brawls on the playground. I think that's what they were worried about. Mm-hmm. I think they were worried about angering parents at home. And, you know, one of my classmates, whose name I won't mention for obvious reasons, her initials were KKK, and they were that way for a reason. It was an intentional thing. So the teachers didn't want to rile anyone up. But these are the same teachers that played Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech in the classroom. And I remember being 8 years old and hearing that speech. And King saying, I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of slaves and sons of slaveholders will come together at the table of brotherhood. And it was at that moment that I realized that I was a part of that story. I was a part of this larger American story. And so at that point, I really wanted to find the Black Tomlinsons and get to know them.
Talk about the initial contacts that you had and what it took to get people to trust you.
My initial contacts with the descendants of slaves of Tomlinson Hill was not with the Tomlinson. It was actually with the Travis. And I tell the story in the book how a young slave named Milo really didn't want to take the Tomlinson name. And he just picked one off of a sign on his way to the courthouse that day to register as a citizen and chose Travis. To be his name instead of Tomlinson, because the suggestion is that the white Tomlinsons wanted their former slaves to have their name to maintain some sort of control and accountability of them. And what I was surprised at was first, you know, I introduced myself as Chris Tomlinson, and he instantly knew. He was an older man, maybe in his late 60s, and he instantly knew where I was coming from. He lived on Tomlinson Hill. He had known the white Tomlinsons before me. For him to meet a white Tomlinson was as natural as opening the door that afternoon. For me, it was incredibly awkward. Mm-hmm. And I learned from that. I learned that I just needed to be as frank and as transparent as possible. No one's ever asked me to apologize or show some sort of remorse, but I feel, you know, a duty for some contrition in my approach. I would say that, you know, when I reached out to LeVar and LaDainian Tomlinson, the two young men who were part of my contemporaries, they were very resistant to talking to me.
And that's in part because many people know much more about sports than I do, but people probably recognize the name LaDainian Tomlinson, and he had dealt with the media before.
Yes. LaDainian, retired running back for the San Diego Chargers, future Hall of Famer, one of the best running backs in NFL history. he'd experienced a New York Times reporter going to meet his dad on the Hill. And his dad was having problems with drug abuse. He was disabled, had a problem with prescription drugs. And LaDainian was trying to help him, trying to get him into rehab. And the New York Times story made it out to appear that LaDainian wasn't doing enough for his father. And that embarrassed him. And also, like my father, LaDainian's father and LeVar's father did not want to talk about the family history. Oliver Tomlinson wasn't proud of being a sharecropper working for the white Tomlinsons when he was a kid. He wanted his children to be more forward-looking. So there was a lot to overcome.
What did you learn about how the first white Tomlinsons got to Texas relatively recently before the Civil War and started up Tomlinson Hill?
Well, the land was first bought by a man named Churchill Jones, and that was in 1849. And he bought this huge amount of land for almost nothing. And he was an entrepreneur at the time. That's what he did. He bought undeveloped land, brought in slave labor, created a profitable plantation, and then either sold it or used the money to buy new land and continue expansion. His wife was the first Tomlinson on Tomlinson Hill, a woman named Susan Tomlinson Jones. And she picked out a plot for her brother and wrote home to Alabama and said, you know, brother, you should come. We'll give you this really great mortgage and you'll be able to expand your plantation empire. And he did. He brought his 48 slaves from Alabama. And they arrived right. The family finally moved in 1860. There were several years where they were developing the land before the family moved from Alabama. And this was a time that a lot of slaveholders were moving to Texas for fear of the Civil War.
Really a remarkable story of the day that the Tomlinson slaves discovered that they were free. And of course, we know emancipation came later to Texas than a lot of other places. But what did you learn?
Well, you're right in that the slaves in Texas were the last to be emancipated. And the proclamation was made on June 19th, which we celebrate as Juneteenth. And it was published in the newspaper. The Galveston Weekly News was the statewide newspaper at the time. And slowly word worked its way up the Brazos. And James K. Tomlinson, who'd been in part of the state militia, had been ill for some time with what I believe is malaria. And he asked to be carried out to a live oak tree outside his home. And he was carried out on a stretcher by the former slaves. And that's when he sat up and called them together and said, "You're as free as me. You're welcome to stay and work for wages, but, you know, I don't control you any longer." He was then carried back into his home and died a few weeks later.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Chris Tomlinson about his new book, Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. He's in town for a signing event this evening at 7 at the Barnes & Noble on Northwest Highway in Dallas. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Chris Tomlinson. He writes these days for the Houston Chronicle, and he's author of the new book Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Chris, you have the story of James K. Tomlinson telling the people he had kept enslaved, all right, emancipation has happened, you're as free as I am. But ultimately, that really wasn't true.
No, it wasn't. The Union troops who came to Texas, first thing they did was tell the freed men and women, stay where you are. There's really no place for you to go. We're not going to take care of you. There's no place in the North for you to go. The best thing you can do is stay exactly where you are, sign a contract with your former slaveholder, and keep doing what you've been doing, except collect the pay instead of doing it in bondage. And for the most part, that's what these families did. I mean, there were a few individuals who wanted to be reunited with family members, but if it was a complete nuclear family, it was more than likely it just stayed right there on the plantation and kept working. And almost immediately, the Texas politicians, the veterans of the Confederacy, went about instituting a new system that that was basically slavery by another name.
One of the reasons that newly freed people might have taken the surnames of their former owners was because they had this deal to sharecrop for them.
That's right. But it was also, there are reports of coercion. I don't know exactly what happened with the Tomlinson families, but it was a way to prevent competition among the planters for labor. Texas actually had a shortage of labor in 1865. It had an enormous cotton crop coming in. There weren't enough hands to work the fields. And so this was one way of saying, you know what, you know, you can't go work on Johnson's plantation. You're a Tomlinson. Your last name's Tomlinson. You're supposed to stay on this plantation and work for me.
What did you learn about what it's like to pick cotton?
Well, I asked one of the black Tomlinsons, a man named Charles, who's now 89 years old, celebrated a birthday on Saturday, how to do it. I invited him to walk the hill with me, and I asked him to tell me his stories and show me the hill the way he lived it. And there was cotton in the fields ready to be picked. And he taught there are two ways. There's picking and there's pulling. And picking is when you take your fingertips and you kind of jam it inside the bowl and you pull out just the fluff. Pulling was you just grab the whole bowl and all the crispy shell on the outside, pull the whole thing off, snap it off the twig, and throw it in the bag. And each cotton bowl is about the weight of a cotton ball you'd buy in the store. And Charles used to pick 1,000 pounds of cotton a day, they call it sun to sun, from sun up to sundown.
You think about that weight. I mean, that you could fill a car and not get 1,000 pounds of cotton into a car.
That's about right. Yeah, that's absolutely correct. That's a lot. That's a lot of bending over in the hot sun, scratching your fingers on these dried out plants, and doing it for hour after hour after hour.
And let's talk about the economics of sharecropping, just through the lens of your ancestors and the ancestors of the people that they had in slavery that then worked for them as sharecroppers. First of all, after the war, it was a bad situation for your family because they did not have this source of free labor. They had been in debt for their land, but they were able to pull back out of this debt, I suppose, based on sharecropping labor.
That's right. My family was bankrupt at the end of the Civil War because they had $21,000 in loans for which the slaves were collateral. And so when my great-great-grandfather died and the slaves were no longer available as collateral, that left one of my great-great-grandmother in bankruptcy and deep in debt, and it took her 6 years to pay off that debt by working the fields with the with her former slaves.
So she was out there picking right next to them and planting?
No, I don't think it ever got to that. She just took over the management role.
Mm-hmm.
She kept track of who was picking how much, because really for slaveholders, the labor was like a machine. They treated it like an input into a factory. And applying the whip was like applying grease to a machine. It was just what you had to do as part of maximizing output, maximizing profit from the plantation. And I think she continued to do that. There were complaints filed both ways, blacks complaining about Sarah. Sarah complaining about her laborers not living up to their part of the contract. And one of the things they ended up doing was coming up with this idea of farming on shares, where a family was given, a black family was given 40 acres that they were responsible for. The landowner would provide the seed, clothing, groceries, all of the needs for the family for the year. They would collect those things from a storekeeper who was in cahoots with the landowner. And the deal was that the first two-thirds of the crop that came in would go to the landowner. Those were the best two-thirds of the crop, the best part of the crop. And then the last third, the worst part of the cotton crop, would go to the sharecropper. Cotton would be sold. Then there would be a settling of debt. How much did the family owe to the landowner, and how much money did the cotton bring in? And inevitably, because the people who kept the books were the landowners, the African-American family would either find that it just barely broke even, or it was in debt and obligated to work the next year. And Sarah, by keeping those books, was able to get her family out of bankruptcy while maintaining the cheap labor that she'd enjoyed for a decade.
It almost sounds like financially, comparing that to a system where you ostensibly own these other human beings, I mean, it sounds like a wash. Like, sharecropping doesn't sound like it was much worse for white families than having held these individuals in slavery.
In the letters that my relatives write, they brag about how this is just as good. I can't believe we went to war over this. If I knew this was how it was going to be using free labor, I would have agreed to it a long time ago. But then you read the accounts of the former slaves, and they'll tell you that, you know, slavery didn't begin until after emancipation for them, because suddenly the white families weren't worried about preserving the lives and the health of their labor. If you've got $21,000 in debt, where you're using slaves as collateral, you have an interest in maintaining the health and the and of those slaves. You want them to be in the best possible condition in case you need to sell them to settle your debt. Well, when you're using labor, there's no interest in maintaining the health or even having an interest in the well-being of your labor. All you care about is the cotton that comes in from the fields.
And what a heartbreak to realize that this thing that you have dreamed about is like freedom in name only.
Well, and that's where, frankly, the freedmen and women didn't, they recognized pretty quickly that freedom was not all that it was cut out to be if things stayed the way they were. And that's one of the more fascinating parts of this story, is how the freedmen and freedwomen developed these communities, these what would later be called freedom colonies, where they developed a self-sufficient community that was apart and separate from the larger white community. And they would build it on, they would build churches and schools and shops and even small hotels, hidden in the sandy parts where the whites didn't care about the land, or in the river bottoms, or along creek beds, or hidden in the woods. You know, they made sure that their children were educated. 95% of African Americans in Texas were illiterate in 1865. That was down to 30% by 1890. That's with almost little or no real assistance from the white community. So they immediately realized that, you know, they weren't going to get their 40 acres and a mule, and that they were going to have to take care of themselves.
Is there archaeological evidence left on Tomlinson Hill of some of these sort of communities and the way that people came together in the years following the Civil War?
I was very excited a couple of years ago to go to the rededication of the Bull Hill Cemetery, which was a slave cemetery between the Jones and Tomlinson plantations. It was discovered thanks to archaeology. The graves were unmarked. Archaeologists came in with special equipment, mapped it out. And they also found the records in the black funeral home of the people who were buried there. So they know who was buried there. It's now a historical marker. On Tomlinson Hill itself, there's still two corn cribs that were fashioned before the Civil War that are still standing. But sadly, you know, there are places like the Gravel Hill Church, which is in the center of Tomlinson Hill, and it's collapsing. It's about to fall. It's literally about to fall over. And that's a shame because that's where my where LaDainian and LeVar's great-great-great-grandparents were married in 1863.
How closely had they – their father didn't want to talk much about that history, but they had other relatives there as well that they would go visit. How closely had they traced their family history before you got in touch with them?
Not at all. I mean, they knew their grandmother. Their grandfather had died before they were born. Their father hadn't spoken about it, and their parents had divorced when they were young. So really, this was a path of discovery for both of us.
So Waco sort of felt like their hometown in many ways, but they would go back and visit. And then when they went to Tomlinson Hill, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised now having read the book, but it's a place that for them is filled with really warm memories.
Well, Tomlinson Hill ultimately became a freedom colony. When one of my cousins decided to sell some land and move towards ranching and give up cotton growing on the majority of his land, he took the land where the old slave quarters had been and subdivided it into 51-acre lots and gave the descendants of the hill of the slaves from the hill first dibs on building a home on it. So that was in the late 1940s. By the time LaDainian and LeVar were and their sister Landria were kids in the late 70s, early 80s, the white Tomlinsons were gone. Their grandfather and their grandmother were the patriarchs of that community. And they thought Tomlinson Hill was named for them. And in some ways, it keeps its name because of their family, not because of mine.
What's the larger community? It's Marlin, Texas?
Marlin, Texas is the county seat for Falls County, and it's about 5 miles from the hill.
What's it like today?
It's a struggling little agricultural town. It has been devastated by the loss of agricultural jobs. It's seen its population cut in half since a high point pre-World War II, when it was famous for its healing mineral waters and had 5 hotels and 3 opera houses and 4 hospitals, and was one of the main stops on the rail line between Dallas and Houston. But I-35 and I-45 have gone around it, and so the people there are still struggling. We made a documentary film about the town and how it still struggles with the echoes of slavery today, as the community has a hard time overcoming the racial barrier to work together to solve their problems.
What's at the source of that today for people who are generations removed but continue to be affected by the repercussions of slavery? Is it about trust? Is it about economic divisions? Is it possible to identify the thing that makes it hardest for people of two races to come together?
I think it's a generational question. I think one of the things you keep hearing from both white and black residents of Marlin is the powers that be, the old families that own the most land and own the big businesses. You know, it's so amorphous. It's hard to know whether or not it's just an urban myth or not. But that they—
Or rural myth.
Or rural myth in this case. But it was the older generation. It was the pre-civil rights generation that liked things the way they were, and they controlled the city council, and they didn't want new businesses coming to town to compete with them. They didn't want change. They didn't want the cost of labor to go up, because what little labor they still needed in the fields, they wanted that labor to be cheap. So they didn't want new employers to compete with the limited workforce. And this was all happening in the 70s and the 80s. I think today when I go to Marlin, you see people who are under 40, and you see interracial couples, and you see a much more progressive and exciting outlook for the town and this desire to save it and to rehabilitate the town. Unfortunately, the mineral water that made it so famous in the 20s makes the city water supply kind of smelly now. Mm-hmm. And so they're still struggling to overcome that problem. But I'm hopeful that as this, you know, the people who were responsible for defending Jim Crow in its last years in the 50s and the 60s, as they move on, this younger generation is making a real difference.
We're speaking with journalist Chris Tomlinson about his new book, Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. He's in town for a signing event tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store in Dallas on Northwest Highway. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, maybe tell a story about your own family's history, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Houston Chronicle journalist Chris Tomlinson, author of the new book Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. You mentioned earlier, Chris, that no one, no black Tomlinson that you met ever said, apologize, but you sort of felt this urge to do just that?
Not so much apologize, but to, because, you know, it's a hard line, right? To what point am I culpable? To what point did I benefit? And I think culpability and being the beneficiary of a wrong done in the past are two different things. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that as someone who's benefited from a system that guaranteed that I had an advantage over other people, particularly minorities and African Americans, that I had a responsibility to bear witness to what happened, to make an honest accounting and reckoning of what happened and how I may have benefited from it.
Let's talk about how you came to recognize that, because you didn't grow up with a lot of money. There are people who are probably in a similar position to yours who are white, that you would see as having benefited from white privilege that would not recognize that. Can you talk about how you came to see that there was white privilege involved in where you are today, even if you didn't sort of ask for it?
I joined the Army within weeks of graduating high school because that's what I needed to do. And I wasn't ready to go to college yet. And so I don't come from a wealthy family. I realized, though, by serving in the military, frankly, you know, that I would go places with my black comrades and see how I was treated differently from them, or that I, while we were based in Japan or Germany, I was able to gain access to places they weren't because of my skin color. In Africa, I was always treated with privilege because I was a white person from the West. And so having experienced those extreme feelings of privilege, when I came back, I began to notice how I enjoyed them here because, you know, as a white person, I can show up to a nice restaurant and I don't really need to be dressed up for people to assume that I belong there. Mm. I'm able to mix and mingle with any economic, socioeconomic level, and people don't look at me like, oh, I wonder what he did to belong here. So I think that the American myth is that we're all judged on our individual merits, and that, you know, we don't inherit, we don't have a class system, or we don't have a system of privilege. But we do. We really do. After 200 years, we've developed one, and I've come to recognize it. And part of writing the book is to help people see it as well.
So how did your experience of being in South Africa at the end of apartheid affect the way you thought about the importance of acknowledging wrongdoing as a first step, even if you don't know what comes next?
In South Africa, they quickly recognized that what they needed to do was heal the differences. They needed to reconcile the different groups, the Afrikaners, the English-speaking whites, the Khoisas and the Zulus and all the other tribes and political parties. And that through the struggle, a lot of people had done a lot of bad things. And putting everyone in jail who'd ever done anything wrong was not an option. They needed a path toward justice that did not involve putting half the country in prison. Same thing in Rwanda, you know, where, you know, almost half the country participated in the genocide in some way. There was no way all those people could go to jail. So, you know, you had to find a way to reconciliation. And the one thing that every justice system has is a need to establish the facts, establish the truth as to what happened. Invite everyone to testify, whether it's the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa or the Gacaca tribal courts in Rwanda. Everyone comes. The perpetrator speaks the truth in front of the victims. The victims can speak their truth and challenge the perpetrator if they try to lie. And the goal is not to humiliate or to punish, but to clear the air, so that everyone can agree on what happened. And then you can get together and say, well, this is why I did what I did, and or this is why my ancestors did what they did. And now that we've had this honest conversation, let's talk about how we can move forward and build a better nation. And that's kind of the inspiration for this book.
How is it different when something like that actually works, and what goes wrong when somehow that doesn't work?
You know,
because I have to imagine it's not just that simple that everyone says, I'm really, you know, I was wrong. Here's what I did. Great. Now let's be neighbors.
In both of those systems, there is, you know, and even in our legal system, if you commit perjury, that's a crime in itself. The same thing in Gacaca, same thing in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Your immunity only comes when you speak the truth, mm-hmm. and when you deny the truth or when you lie, there that's when you're punished. You're rewarded for telling the truth. You're punished for telling a lie. You know, I've covered a lot of civil wars, Sudan, Congo, Uganda, Somalia, to name a few. Iraq really was a civil war almost as soon as we invaded it. And the one thing that every civil war has in common is, and all bigotry has in common, is that you have one group that has power and privilege, and they are unjustly denying power and privilege to another group. And you can make excuses for that denial of power, whether it's race or ethnicity or skin tone. But it's that fundamental injustice that leads people to go out and sell the plow and pick up a Kalashnikov and go to war. So we all have an interest in having a truthful conversation about what really happened. It promotes justice, and justice promotes a better society. And that was my lesson from all the conflicts I've seen.
It seems that if it's not race, it's religion. If it's not religion, it's clan. If it's not clan, it's gender. What is it about human nature that very often when a small group of us can seize power, we do so to the exclusion of anybody we declare to be in the out-group because they're wearing a red hat or for whatever reason?
We know that bigotry comes from, you know, one of the more primitive parts of our brains, the amygdala, and it's the fight or flight mechanism. It's the competition for resources. It's the idea that I want my progeny to succeed and I will do whatever's necessary to make sure that happens. And you're quite right. In you know, 3,000 years ago, people of different ethnicities didn't mix. We were more likely to encounter a competing tribe that looked just like us. So we had these markers. And that's what neuroscientists have learned, is that bigotry is taught. We have to be taught who to fear, who to compete with, who to hate. And that it can be something as we're going to hate the people who wear red feathers behind their right ear, or we can be taught to hate someone because of the color of their skin. But once that lesson's taught, the biology is exactly the same. But who to hate is something we have to learn.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Sharon in Arlington. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I just wanted to I'm going to try to make it out to the book signing this evening, and wanted to just mention my family is part of the McCain plantation out of Greenwood, or I should say Tioga, Mississippi, which is Carroll County. And it's the similar story. You have two families, one black, one white, and it is like a Senator McCain family from that particular region. They've done a couple stories on it, and I think because it was Senator McCain, but we had been meeting probably since the 80s and just trying to document the history of that community. And I think one of the things I came away with after this particular meeting, we were just there this past weekend, was that if there is a biological connection or not, it feels like that whole community is a family, in a sense that, how you say, you bring someone in from, you know, another country, they know no other place, and you make them part of your family for all these years, and all of a sudden when slavery is over, it's like, where do they go? What do they do? So to me, there is some culpability to say, how do you make these people whole? But at the same time, how do you not acknowledge them as a family of sorts? Does that make sense?
Really interesting point. Do you want to respond to that, Chris? Thanks so much for your call, Sharon.
Well, I mean, LeVar and I consider ourselves family. His mom and I consider ourselves family. Though, you know, we have no biological connection that we're aware of. You know, and it's just, you know, growing up as a little kid, you know, we used to call each other cousins, and even though we're not related, or when your lives are intertwined, when there's a connection, and particularly when there's one that's gone on for 200 years, I don't think you can or should deny that. You know, by all accounts, LaDainian's grandfather and the last white Tomlinson to live on the hill were best of friends, but I'm pretty sure that wasn't an equal relationship.
I think we have time to take one more call. Let's go to Corrine in Oak Cliff. Hi, Corrine.
Yes. My my mom's family is from that same part of the country. I don't know if he ever encountered the Tollers or a area called Beck Prairie. It's over toward Franklin.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
But I'm also curious about how would I go to actually do some more research on my family and other than the family stories?
That I know you can answer.
You know, doing African American genealogy is a real challenge, and it requires some detective work. And it also depends, frankly, on how well the 1860 and 1850 slave schedules were filled out. Sometimes all you have is a gender and an age to work with, and you kind of have to track that geographically and through age and gender into the 1870 census to get people's names. Mm. What was particularly useful to me was, frankly, going to the Falls County Courthouse and looking up the wedding records, the death certificates, the mortgage records, the land ownership records. And they're all written by hand in these 2-foot by 3-foot leather-bound books. And it's just hours and hours of hard work, but I found it rewarding.
Can you forgive your ancestors for the things that they did to other people?
No. And I would say it's because I was always taught that, oh, they didn't know any better. But my research shows that they did. You know, I read the newspapers they read. I know what books were popular when they were there. I know what was being taught at church. And there were plenty of people, plenty of really amazing people who, in the community, who stood up and said, you know what, this is wrong. We shouldn't be doing this. My ancestor's next door neighbor was a man named Shields, who was opposed to slavery and told the Tomlinsons that.
A white
neighbor named Shields. There was another white neighbor named Etheridge who did the same thing. So, you know, there were people who were doing the right thing, and my ancestors chose to do what was best for them economically, and for that, you know, they made a choice, and it's one I can't respect.
Journalist Chris Tomlinson writes for the Houston Chronicle. His new book is called Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. He's in town for a signing event tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. Chris, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.